And at the same time, the expectation is very high. The response from the children is also going to be very low.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because the with the expectations that are higher than the capacity of the child, there's also very little room for giving in, very little room for understanding the child's need.
All right.
So you find these kind of parents, basically, they want their children to have 20 out of 20 in school in every single class of them, or to have A stars everywhere. They expect them to, the child to come back from school and be reading the Quran and reading 3-4 books at a time, and also doing a lot of exercise, also cleaning up their room and cleaning up the whole house as well, and praying on time and sleeping on time. And they've got a whole schedule for their child.
What they expect from a child.
They expect a huge amount of things from a child, not giving in so much, not understanding the needs of the child.
I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio at irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Islamic upbringing. We are talking about the role of father and mother in the teenager's life. Yes, brother, you were saying that they are dictator kind of parents who expect a lot from their children and they're not giving in much input.
What we need to do and understand is that a true and a very balanced approach is what we need to kind of have in our family, where the expectations must be reasonable expectations based on the reality of the situation, of the child's needs, the child's abilities and potential. At the same time, there's also always room for flexibility. And once you understand this, you realize that when we're dealing with teenagers, you have clear expectations and you also have clear red lines, and you build a bridge based on respect and love to make sure that whilst the expectations are met and whilst the clear lines, the clear red lines basically are maintained, okay, there's also this atmosphere of very strong love, very strong respect basically. And this requires both parents to be in synchrony with this. So mm-hmm. both father and mother ensure that they expect from the child an amount that is according to the child's needs and capacity and potential.
True.
At the same time, they've cleared out those expectations. They've made sure that the child knows about these expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And also they've cleared out the red lines as well, that this is the thing we don't accept in this house, for example. This is the kind of lines we won't cross. So I expect you to kind of stay in these boundaries. So
all right.
Just to give an example, for example, being out of the house after 10 p.m., for example.
Yes.
Right? Or
screen time after 9 p.m.
For example. I mean, just running an example, just so that the child also knows there are clear red lines.
Yeah.
As much as we can, we make red lines based on the Sharia. Whatever is haram is obviously the main red line that we need to have. And then things that are harmful or things that are related to social etiquette, etc.
Yeah.
Now, when it comes to the difference between a father and
mother.
A mother, one of the places where it manifests a lot is in how we deal with a child in relation to these rules and regulations or these expectations and the red lines. But as I mentioned firstly, that both the parents are in synchrony with this. So they should have talked with each other, and the child should also know that both mom and dad are aware of this expectation and they're aware of the red lines as well. And that is how the family works.
Mm-hmm.
However, the side that will be putting out these expectations or putting out these red lines and ensuring that this happens is the role of the father.
All right.
The father plays the role of that strength, that authority, that final
power.
The power or the final decision making basically rests with the father. And in a stable, in a very balanced Islamic family, this is very clear.
Okay.
The role of the father is the father says which are the red lines. The father makes those red lines and ensures that the family kind of has this red lines in place.
Okay. What else? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the roles of parents, a father and a mother, in the life of a teenager. Brother, you said that the role of a father should be specified. It should be clear that father is the main authority, the main decision maker of the family.
And at the same time, as you mentioned, the father's role is this strength and the final decision, basically. On the other side, the mother's role is to kind of play the loving, the gentleness, the place where
Sobel.
There is more softness, basically.
Okay.
Right? That covers the aspect of the kind of emotions.
Yeah.
Right. Now, let me make this very, very clear. And I don't want any misunderstanding to happen over here. We're not saying that father plays a ruthless, violent role and the mother plays a very emotional kind of role. No, that's not what we're saying.
Okay.
The father also has to show a lot of love, has to show a lot of kindness, a lot of gentleness. And at the same time, the mother has to also be very firm and very stable.
Mm-hmm.
It shouldn't be the case that children should go to their mom to break all the rules, basically.
Yes.
That never happens, right? The point is not this. The point is that the kind of aspect and the kind of attitude and the kind of role is defined in a family. And this is seen by the children. They
yes.
see that this happens. But they also get the same amount of love from the dad. And at the same time, they don't break rules because mom said so or because
yes.
mom will allow to rules break. Mom doesn't allow the rules to be broken. But mom allows that emotional aspect to be covered. If there's a need for an explanation, for example, there's a need for a shoulder to cry on, you usually go to your mom, for example.
Yes.
Again, I emphasize, it doesn't mean you don't go to your dad, right? The kind of the roles are naturally formed like this. And you find that this is the kind of very stable house that will bring about very confident children. One of the aspects, and one of the, I would say, the challenges that we face today is that when these roles are mixed up, you find that a child, when he enters teenagers, they are of very weak personalities.
They're not confident.
They're not confident, they don't have self-esteem, they don't know where they stand, they don't know how to express their personalities. And one reason, I'm not saying the only reason, but one of the reasons is because at home there's an imbalance. There's massive decisions and authority that the mother takes when she's not
All
supposed
right.
to. And at the opposite side, the father plays no role in the family, completely quiet figure within the family. This leads to...
Dominated by a female.
Exactly. And this leads to a boy, for example, who's growing up to be very...
Weak person.
Weak in his personality.
Okay.
Right? Unable to make decisions, unable to stand on their feet, be independent, unable to aim for high things, be very low in confidence. At the same time, as girls lacking this need for that support from a manly figure... Not having the father's support and the father's love and respect for a daughter leads to them also being very weak of character. So this
All
is
right.
a very important point that we need to take care and keep in mind when dealing with children.
Okay. So, these were very important things that parents need to keep into consideration while they are dealing with teenagers. You said that if a woman is dominant at home and father has no authority, both whether it's a boy or a girl... who are in their teens, they will develop into weak personalities, and parents definitely need to take care of that. Well, that was all for today. Thank you so much, brother, for joining us. Thank you so much to our listeners for being with us. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us or any suggestions, comments for a program, please feel free to contact us on EnglishRadio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
Visitors and staff at a French zoo have celebrated the first birthday of twin pandas. The young bears were given a tasty treat of frozen cakes and other treats. As part of the event, five lucky visitors were also given the chance to participate in the celebrations behind the scenes with golden tickets. Other festivities included face painting and panda-themed activities. The baby pandas were born last August and now weigh 23 and 28 kilograms. They live with their mother at Zoo Parc de Bouval, where they have been on display since their arrival in 2021.
Many people develop deeper relationship with four-legged animals, treating them like their own kids. A Kenyan conservationist is one of them. 33-year-old Salome Lemasia has been a community ranger in Sierra Conservancy, northern Kenya, since 2015. The mother of four is stationed at a rhino sanctuary and is in charge of protecting a male rhino named Loijipo. At just a few days old, Loijipo was abandoned by his mother, possibly due to her being spooked by something. After being cared for, he was returned to the sanctuary under surveillance in an attempt to rewild him. 3 years on, from his release into Sierra Wilderness, he is taking his time to carve out his territory, of course, with the help of Salome. The chest fever in the southern Indian city of Chennai is on a peak as the 44th International Chess Olympiad kicks off there. Students created a mammoth chessboard on the playground and dressed up as 32 chess pieces to promote the game. For 2 weeks, Chennai is hosting nearly 2,000 players from 188 countries. For the first time in nearly 100 years of history of the Chess Olympiad, India is playing host. The event will run until August the 10th. Ahead of the game, 150 underprivileged children from various government schools were given the opportunity to fly. These were the students who won in a district-level chess tournament. Excited spectators gather at the Solberg Airport in the U.S. for the 39th New Jersey Lottery Festival of Ballooning.
We have about 45 balloons here today, including these spectacular special shapes. Our signature New Jersey Lottery Sunny Days balloon. You can see the tiger. Unicorn is hiding behind there. Tasmanian Devil, unique photo panda. We are having a spaceship. There's Billy the Kid. Spectacular presentation. You won't believe your skies this weekend.
Dozens of hot air balloons were test inflated in preparation for the real deal. The festival is considered the largest summertime event in New Jersey. Reddington City officials have predicted about 170,000 people will join the festival over the weekend. Weather forecasts say the skies are gentle enough for over 100 balloons to take flight in the morning and evening in mass ascents. And no one is more excited than the festival producer, who has been planning the event for months.
Including these spectacular special shapes. The balloons bring out the kid in everyone. You know, I've done this for a long time. This is the 39th annual one. But still, when I hear that propane whirring and these balloons going up, it makes the hair on my arm stand up.
The producer says these balloons will be handled by professional pilots and other balloons will be available for rides. The festival will last for 3 days, ending with food vendors, games, amusement rides, and other entertainment. There will also be a massive fireworks display, as well as a nighttime feature of glowing balloons. The annual festival is the largest seasonal hot air balloon festival in North America. It draws in thousands of visitors every year.
You might think twice about throwing out your old trainers after this story. A startup in Tunisia breathes new life into old shoes as artists restore and even customize the footwear. The new business is called Kenenti and is located in the capital, Tunis. Here, the team uses fabrics, laces, and leather recovered from various factories for the repair work. The creative artists work on every detail during each project, even the soles of the shoes. The work aims to find solutions to shoe waste and reuse items instead of adding them to the world's landfills. Cherif Zeroui is the co-founder of Kenenti. He says the idea came to him 2 years ago when he discovered the number of shoes thrown away each year in Tunisia.
In France, there were 100 million pairs of shoes thrown away every year. This is a huge figure for us, and for the ecosystem and for the earth. In Tunisia, it's almost the same given the population. There were 3 or 4 million shoes thrown away every year. So we thought of giving added value to these shoes, so we restored them.
Zerbui also says he is happy to create jobs for those willing to participate regardless of the educational degree. Besides shoes, these artists dabble in restoring worn-out handbags, giving them a brand new look. Many of the artists and interns say they are proud to be part of this unique project. They say they feel like a family there. The startup is the first trainer restoration business to be launched in North America. Would you buy a pair of scrap tire sandals? Well, in the Vietnamese capital, Hanoi, you will find all kinds of handmade sandals from recycled tires. The famously rugged footwear of the Viet Cong have traveled vast distances over the decades. Shoemakers use sharp knives and chisels to craft a sandal from huge tires. For those seeking a nod to yesteryear, the hard-sole sandals are available at markets and small stores alike, with prices ranging from $2,000 to $1,000. The Vietnamese first began making rubber sandals in the late 1940s during the first Indochina War against the French, using tires from ambushed army trucks. They found the sandals were cheap to make and survive well in wet, muddy, and hilly conditions. Even in peacetime, the design remains popular for sustainability reasons.
Living through a pandemic is strange as we are often locked indoors, but a UK-based Indian mechanical engineer made the best use of his time during the coronavirus lockdown and built an aeroplane. 38-year-old Ashok Ali Serial, who is also a private pilot, had long dreamt of a personal aircraft. He initially planned to order an aircraft kit and built it with his colleagues. But he says the 2020 lockdown left him with no choice but to complete it on his own. Now he has an aircraft which he has named after his youngest daughter, Dia. The plane can carry up to 4 people, including the pilot, and fly about 250 kilometers an hour. After getting clearance to fly, he flew across 4 European countries with his friends. He has also gone on a trip with his family of 4. Some gardens are decorated with genomes and other cute ornaments, but this garden uses tank debris to stand out amongst others. The intention of the gardener isn't to have the most army-themed patch. Valeria tried to remove the tank, but ultimately, because of its size and weight, it was impossible. So he just let it stay. The owner says he is used to having the tank there, even though it reminds him of hard times. Next to the wreckage, this family has planted cabbage and potatoes, which they harvest and use each year. The tank was left over from the war between Russia and Ukraine that began earlier this year. British paleontologists have made an exciting fossil discovery which has been identified as the earliest known animal predator.
It's quite a large fossil. It's the preserved part is at least 20 centimetres tall, and it would have lived attached to the seafloor bottom. But it's a broken specimen, so we actually don't know how large the entire colony is. This is only a fragment of it.
Wilby says the animal had a stalk and a cup on top with little tentacles, which most likely used to catch food out of the water. The ancient animal is related to sea anemones, jellyfish and corals, and pushes the known existence of these species back to 20 million years. Wilby explains the fossil displays a key point in the evolution of animal. The fossil is said to be around 560 million years old and was discovered in Charnwood Forest, northern England, amongst over 1,000 other fossils.
Iran's city of Rafsanjan has hosted an international talent contest dubbed Stage Stars. The event is aimed at providing a chance for stage talents from across the world to come in the spotlight. Yusuf Jalali reports from Rafsanjan.
This is a global stage for talents. The 5th International Stage Stars Festival wrapped up with the announcement of winners, who have been competing in 4 categories of singing, voice acting, show hosting, and sound impression. The top performances from each category won the golden mic and a cash prize.
The festival was a place for more serious competition between those who have a say in a stage performance. I'm so happy to be chosen by the jury as the best show host of the contest.
It was an amazing event for talents. I'm so glad to be part of this. Talents from all across Iran and many parts of the world competed in the festival, so winners should be proud of themselves.
Held in Iran's city of Rafsanjan, the 2-day event brought together participants from 14 countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, Kyrgyzstan, Nigeria, and Turkey, to flaunt their neck for stage performance. The jury is comprised of top Iranian actors, TV presenters, and voice artists. They say the competition has been tough, and those who stood out are real stage stars.
We tried our best to pick talents who really acted like professionals on stage. Not only should they care about the standards and principles of a stage performance, but they must innovate, improvise and stand out.
This festival acted like a university for stage talents. It taught a lot of lessons about the stage to participants, especially for those who failed to win the contest.
Organizers say this contest is not just about scouting for stage talents. They say the event helps shine a spotlight on talents and lead them to their community. All of the contestants, even those who come from foreign countries, must perform in Persian. However, organizers plan to include other languages in the upcoming editions of the festival.
To those who won the golden mic here, this is a dream come true. But they say, aside from the prize, Stage Stars has marked a milestone in their pursuit of success, since they have now come under the spotlight. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Rafsanjan.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio, we have very special guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Murtaza Karimi, an Islamic expert from the Islamic Hawza of Qum. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me.
So, we have been discussing in our previous discussion some strange cases and instances which took place after the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which might not be understood easily by the rational sciences, or it's better to say, the normal mentality of the people, because they look very much metaphorical, symbolic, and miraculous. For example, one of them was shedding tears by the earth and the sky and the glorification of the earth and the skies and the heavens, we can say, related to the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. If agree, I enumerate some other cases and then you bring up the authentic references of them taking place.
Sure.
For instance, about one of the strange cases which took place, according to some of the documents, and it is documented in the general history of Shia Islam, is shedding blood under the stones on the desert of Karbala. Is it true or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As I mentioned in the previous program, the story of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is unique. Nothing like that has happened before 61 after Hijrah and will not happen till the Day of Judgment. So we should not reject such phenomena because of the fact that, they might seem weird and strange. But again, it doesn't mean that we need to accept everything. We need to refer to the historical books and the collections of hadith to see the narrations which talk about that.
Yes.
So the narrations about the heavens and the earth crying for Imam Hussein alayhi salam are many. And as you rightly mentioned, according to some narrations, on the day of Ashura, at least in some places, when they remove some stones, there was fresh blood under that stone. First of all, nowadays we hear from time to time that the same is going to is happening in some regions in the world. So whether these stories or these stories are true or not, for each case we need to go and check.
Yes.
Because I don't want. My point is that when we hear such a thing in the narrations, which is the case, it doesn't mean that if every person comes to us and tells us a story that in this certain
area
or origin we have seen the same on the day of Ashura, we just accept that. No, the scholars should go mm-hmm. there, and when we receive enough news from trustworthy person, then we may agree.
Yes.
So this is another story. What's happening in our time and era, and there are some stories in different parts of the world.
Or, for example, the stones or the marbles out of the gravestone of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam becomes bloody and red in color. This has been also seen and filmed and documented.
Yeah, it's been documented, but I'm not able to, because myself I've not witnessed it. What we are talking
to
in
prove
today's
it.
Session is just only about what happened on Day of Ashura, based on the narrations.
Okay.
So again, according to some narrations, it has happened at least in the land of Karbala, and in some cases, we have witnesses and reports from some people who have seen that, and they have narrated their story that on that day they, for example, removed one stone and they found fresh blood.
Yes.
So it shows that at least it has happened for some people, for some cases. Did it happen for every stone on the earth? Not necessarily.
No. Okay.
So what we understand from these narrations is that it has happened for some people. They have seen and witnessed that. And there is a very famous narration in both Shia and Sunni sources about the hadith is famous as the hadith of Qarura, a glass. The fact that the Holy Prophet brought some oil, some soil from the land of Karbala to Umm Salama, and she had it in a glass, and she narrates that on a specific day, and the Holy Prophet tells her that the day that you see that the soil turns into blood or it becomes red, then make sure that Hussein alayhi salam has been killed.
Yes.
And Umm Salama narrates the story, and she says that one day I saw the same thing happened, and I made sure that this is the day that Holy Prophet predicted. So we have these stories mentioned in, it's not only limited to Shia sources. It's been mentioned in Sunni sources as well.
Yes.
Now, in this case, we are talking about a physical phenomenon. So it's not like crying of the heavens, which we said that we may explain that in a metaphorical way.
Yes.
No, this is a physical phenomenon happening.
Yes.
And there are narrations talking about that in both Shia and Sunni narrations, and that is why we need to accept that.
They are very much, I think, time-bound because, the specific Ashura, the 10th day of the Muharram in the year 61 AH was a very special day.
Exactly.
These cases might not be repeated, during the other Ashuras,
We need to check.
Yes.
As I mentioned, the point
but
is
But for
that
sure, on that day, some strange things happened on the earth.
Exactly.
Okay, that's all right. Okay.
So for this case, again, we need to say that based on the narrations, we may accept that at least for some cases, for few people, they have seen and they have reported the story.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
That's all right. We know it was a really harsh tragedy, and even so many people, so many members of even the forces of the enemy, we can say, shed tears on Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Their hearts were moved by what happened to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Some of them even on the day of Ashura did repentance and joined the army of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and were martyred on his way. Okay, all of them are related to the human beings. What about the other, we can say, entities? Like, for example, the jinns. Because especially about the jinns and the jinns forces, we have ayahs in the Holy Quran referring to them and their creatures and their creation and their, as I said, entity is absolutely accepted by all the people, especially the Muslims, based on the Quranic text. What about them? For example, any mourning, shedding tears for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam?
Let me, share one point, and that is the fact that when it comes to such details about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, for all these details that you mentioned, we have some narrations.
Yes.
But the number of the narrations differ from one phenomenon to another, mm-hmm. and the authenticity of the chain may differ from one to another.
Yes.
So for some of them, we have so many narrations, and that is why we cannot reject that. So we have it for the heavens and the earth crying for Imam al-Hussein, yes. alayhi salam. And we have it for, finding blood under the stones. Let me at least give the dear listener some sources for the fact that there was blood, fresh blood under, some stones. For example, we have it in Common Ziyarat, page 77, Bihar al-Anwar, volume 45, page 202, Manaqib ibn Shahrashub, volume 1, page 269. And amongst Sunni sources, we may mention Mu'jam al-Kabir by Tabarani, volume 3, page 113 and 119, Majmu' al-Zawa'id, volume 9, page 315, and so on and so forth. For example, one narration reads, "Lamma qutil al-Husayn alayhi salam," when Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was killed, so as you rightly mentioned, it's talking about 61 after Hijrah, the 10th day. "Lam yabqa fi bayt al-Muqaddas or fi bayt al-Maqdis hasatun illa wujda tahtaha damun abid." There was no stone in Bayt al-Maqdis, Jerusalem, except that there was fresh blood under it. Yes. Or in another narration, "Lam yurfa an wajh al-ard hajarun illa wujida tahtahu damun abid."
Yes.
This is mentioned by Sheikh al-Saduq in Al-Amali, page 167. And for the hadith of Qarura and Umm Salama, the listeners may find it in Al-Ishad by Sheikh al-Mufid, volume 2, page 130. And as for Sunni sources, they may refer to Khasa'is al-Kubra, volume 2, page 193, and many other sources.
Yes.
So again, it seems that this is also well authenticated.
Okay. That's all right.
When it comes to jinns crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, in Kamal al-Ziyarat, we have 19 narrations talking about that. Mm-hmm. For example, in one narration we read, "Kanat al-jinnu tanuhu ala al-Husayn ibn Ali alayhi salam." The jinn used to cry and mourn for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. This is in Kamal al-Ziyarat, page 95. And Allama Majlisi also has quoted from Kamal al-Ziyarat, volume 45, page 241. Mm-hmm. Now, there are many discussions about whether all the narrations in Kamal al-Ziyarat are authentic or not. So there is a difference of idea among the Shia scholars. But as I mentioned, at least we have 11 narrations about this. And it seems that this is also well authenticated. And it seems natural that when you have the angels crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the jinn, they also knew about that and they have cried.
Also, it has been documented that an army of jinns were after helping Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. They have also some narrations regarding that.
As for the remaining phenomena, when it comes to, an owl crying for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we have it, but the number of narrations are not many. Mm-hmm. So
an owl, a bird. Owl, you said, okay.
So for this case, we cannot say that for sure it has happened.
Okay.
As for the eclipse, we have some narrations that on that very day an eclipse happened. Mm-hmm. It's been mentioned by both Shia and Sunni sources. And in some narrations, we see that the stars appeared during the day, which is, in line with the eclipse.
Yes.
Because when you have eclipse, then you will be able to see the stars, and there are some narrations proving that too. And it's not against the order of the nature. So, for example, when for some peoples in the previous prophets, we see that for, like, Prophet Nuh alayhi salam, for many days we have rain. Is it against the order of the nature? No. So we cannot reject that story.
Yes.
For an eclipse to happen for a great tragedy like the tragedy of Karbala, is it against the order of the nature? No. It can happen through a miracle. But the narrations, the reports that may talk about an event which seem to be against the nature of the physical world. For example, to see two suns on that very day.
Yes.
It seems that, the intellect, the, scientific data, they reject that.
Okay.
So we might say that the narrations which talk about some phenomena, which are against the intellect and nature, yes. becomes very clear that the Imam of the Ahlbayt alayhi wasalam have not yes. said such a thing okay. because it's not possible. Mm-hmm. But for other narrations, our intellect neither rejects that yes. nor accept that, okay. like crying of the heavens.
It's better to say that the ordinary intellect of the human is incapable of understanding
exactly,
them.
But does not reject that. Reject it says that it might right. happen. So for those cases, we yes. need to check the narrations. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned, for most of the cases that you mentioned, we have some that's narration right. in this regard.
But what is important about the day of Ashura is that so many stories have been given by the previous generations of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, by Imam Ali, Prophet Muhammad. And before that, in so many documents, recently I saw a documentary talking about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, even in the older scriptures, okay? Mm-hmm. Referring to some of the references that on the day of Ashura, coinciding with such and such day according to Judaism or Christianity, some strange things would happen. So it shows the very specific, we can say specific status and the place of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and that specific day. So in this way, we can understand them. That's all right. Thank you very much, Shaykh. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
Inshallah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives us the chance of reaching such a spiritual perfection to understand such things. And in fact, to clean our eyes in order to see such things with our because the eye of the heart and eye of the soul, inshallah, to understand them perfectly, inshallah. Thank you very much, Sheikh. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. You can visit our website at parstoday.com/ENColorofIslam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله الحسين
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثتُ لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear listeners, my sisters and brothers from all around the world, welcome to For a Better Life. This is Arab English Radio. I hope wherever you are, you're doing well. Welcome to another session of Literature Engaged with the Religion. So we were discussing the story of Ashura and what happened in Karbala, and we talked about the literature that has been enriched with so much of poetry and stories that are so passionate and so full of emotions. These poetry are usually in the form of elegies or in the form of what they call as lamentations or something that is mournful and has got the characteristics of the tragedy in itself as well. So in the previous session, we went through a piece of a book that I introduced to you. It is Karbala and Ashura by Ali Hussein Jalali. And we said that there are plenty of incidents in this book that you could see different aspects of human nature that has been clearly outlined for you. As the reader, when you go through the pages of this book, you would see plenty much of nice features attributed to Ahl al-Bayt alayhim as-salam. Of course, it is not just attributed, it is the truth. But through the words of an author, of a poet, who has not been there, perhaps because the writer of this book has actually gone through 14 centuries further of that incident of who's been writing this. So after 14th century, still there are some poets and writers who could do plenty much of justice to what happened there. They use their emotions, their power of writing in order to write such beautiful pieces. Well, you see, in past, the people who study literature are familiar with the idea of muses. Poets and writers believed that there are some sort of muses that would come to their help, and then through the use of those muses, through the benefit and blessing of those muses, these writers and poets would fall into a sort of a sleep, and then they would write down whatever that comes to their mind. But what happens in Islamic heritage is that there is no muse, and all is the power of the writer and of the poet that has been bestowed upon him as a blessing by Allah himself. So we believe that when such beautiful words and poems and melodies come out, there must be a spiritual power behind it. Of course, God has provided these people with a sort of blessing that is not very much common for every single person. That was just a point for the poets and the writers of these sort of spiritual pieces that are full of emotion and that show you so much regarding the human nature and human essence. Allah, Allah, Subhanallah, Allah. Allah, Allah, Allah. This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Allah, Allah, oh, ya Allah, Allah, Allah. You can listen to us at parstoday.com/en. If you have any suggestion, our email is englishradio@irib.ir. So now let's go back to the piece that I read for you. It was about Shimr coming to Imam Hussein alayhi salam's camp and calling upon his relatives who are Abul Fadl al-Abbas and his brothers, because they had a sort of a relativity between them. So he wanted to give them clemency, and then Abul Fadl al-Abbas just rejected him. Of course, there would be no shock that he would reject him, because he is the most loyal brother in the world. If loyalty had an image, then it would have been manifested itself in the picture of Abul Fadl al-Abbas alayhi salam. Aside from his loyalty, we could see the manner of a brother toward his brother. When he has been called by Shimr, he didn't answer him at the first place because he knew that his brother is there. And of course, he had got nothing to do with that guy. So what happened is that He listened to his brother, and if it wasn't about his brother's order to go and see what he's going to say, he would have never gone out of that camp in order to have that negotiation with that guy. Of course, it was not a negotiation because this brother's point of view was totally clear and he knew where he's standing, and he would have never compromised his beliefs and his love that he had for his brother with any sort of clemencies. So he was the one who was about to back his brother up. He was the power of his brother, and he was actually the thing that brought all his army together. So he was the strength of his army. Therefore, it is very obviously that he would have never listened to that clemency sort of a thing and negotiation that happened in there. But it was just an answer to his brother's call, you know. Imam Hussein alayhi salam asked him to go, and he went there. This is not the first time that the manner of a brother is clarified. We see throughout their life, he has never addressed his brother, but as just calling him by his name. Since he's his imam, he is trying to just respect him as a obedient brother who knows that his brother is the imam of every single creature in this world. So much of respect and so much of manner toward his brother shows how respectful and how full of modesty sort of a person he was. So as you can see through literature, so much of these sort of manners have been passed down to us. So the literature of Ashura is not just a matter of telling you a story that happened 14th century ago. It is more of that. It is a school of thought. It is teaching you so much of things. So it is not just a mournful poem that you hear and you shed tears upon it. It is a school of thought that makes you think. It is just like enlightening every single creature in order to have insight. And through those tears that comes to your eyes, you start thinking about the truth behind the story that happened in there. As I just told you, these poets have got this spiritual power in order to share with us this spiritual point of views. So at the same time that they are so touching, so moving, and so heartbreaking, and they cause those tears to gather in your eyes, at the very same time, these poems are meant to make you think and dig deeper and go between the lines of every single part of this story and learn. Because, you know, these stories are not... In literature, we have these didactic form of writings that would teach you very much directly. But what happens in the stories like the story of Karbala is that it is not didactic in a direct way. You go through that story with all your heart, and then you get the main ideas through a journey that you already have been so emotional, and you even have tears upon your cheeks. So it happens by the way of your spirit, by the way of your soul and your heart. And that's the beauty of the literature of Ashura. So this is all the time that we had for today. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have.
Shadows. Part 1.
The war in Yemen was in fact a combination of three battles. Everyone knows about the first war, the resistance by the Ansarullah against the Saudi invasion and the forces supported by Mohammed bin Salman. The second war is a conflict between the Houthis and the Al-Qaeda militants who are supported by Riyadh to make Yemen insecure and crush the Houthis who are Zaydi Shias. But we've heard less often about Yemen's third war. On April 27, 2017, Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi, Mohammed bin Salman's crony, who claims to be Yemen's president, deposed Idarus Qasim Abdul Aziz Al Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, the capital of former South Yemen. The reason for his dismissal was the vast relationship between Zubaydi and a tiny nation on the southern shores of the Persian Gulf, the newly established United Arab Emirates. After the dismissal, a large crowd of Zubaydi supporters took to the streets. The supporters were mobilized by the UAE. Hadi was informed through Saudi agents that the United Arab Emirates was behind all of this. It wasn't the first time that Hadi and bin Salman were informed of the UAE's spontaneous measures. Last winter, Hadi, who usually resided in Saudi Arabia, decided to visit Aden, that was the largest city controlled by the Saudi-backed militants. When Hadi's plane approached the airport in Yemen, as a rule of thumb, it requested to land, but the airport in Yemen didn't allow the plane to land. So the plane had to land kilometers away on the island of Socotra. Hadi was enraged. He fired the director of the airport and ordered the forces under his command to besiege the airport. The UAE-backed forces opened fire at Hadi's forces at the airport. So the rift that everyone was already aware of opened wider. The rift between the UAE and Saudi Arabia,
بين الإمارات والسعودية.
Bin Salman had sensed the danger and initially decided to act as the big brother and impartial mediator to forge reconciliation between Hadi and Abu Dhabi Crown Prince, who's also the UAE's deputy commander-in-chief, Bin Zayed. 2 weeks later, Hadi left for Abu Dhabi, but talks took only 10 minutes. Bin Zayed reminded Hadi that the UAE has paid a lot of money to liberate Yemen. And Hadi told Bin Zayed that the UAE acts like an occupying power in Yemen, not a country that's deployed forces to liberate it. Hadi decided to fire the UAE cronies and his government, which itself was designated by Saudi Arabia. Bin Salman was supposed to teach the UAE a lesson and force them to support Saudi policies and stop going their own way. Finally, on April 27th, 2017, Bin Salman gave Hadi the green light to punish the UAE. Adarus Qasim al-Zubaydi, the governor of Aden, and Hani Ali bin Breik, one of the ministers of Hadi's cabinet, were fired. The UAE reacted quickly. A massive protest in Aden. This time, the groups in Aden sought independence in South Yemen.